A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one after seeing some pretty grim headlines lately. Industrial and agricultural accidents in Israel. Construction sites where dubiously legal labor is common. Safety standards that seem to be enforced with a shrug. He's asking what the most common causes of preventable injury and death actually are in these contexts. Whether the public perception that Israeli construction safety is subpar compared to other developed democracies holds up, and which countries have actually led the way on legislation, inspection, and enforcement. There's a lot to unpack here.
The first thing worth unpacking is that lumping construction and agriculture together, which we all do instinctively, actually obscures two completely different fatality profiles. Construction kills workers in one way, agriculture kills them in another, and the overlap is almost zero.
What's the headline difference?
Construction deaths are overwhelmingly falls from height. Agriculture deaths are overwhelmingly machinery, entanglements, and tractor rollovers. In Israel specifically, falls from height account for roughly 60% of construction fatalities. I'm talking workers falling from scaffolding, through unprotected openings, off roofs, off formwork, and the numbers are genuinely bad. Israel's construction fatality rate per 100,000 workers has been running at roughly 2 to 3 times the OECD average for years now.
The public perception isn't just vibes. It's backed by data.
It's backed by hard data. The most recent comparative figures I've seen put Israel at somewhere around 8 to 11 construction fatalities per 100,000 workers annually, depending on the year. The UK, by comparison, runs at about 1.5 to 2. Germany, around 3 to 4. The United States around 9 to 10, which is actually closer to Israel, but the U.S. is itself an outlier among developed economies on this. The real comparison that stings is that Israel's numbers look more like countries with far less regulatory infrastructure.
Which is strange, because Israel is not short on regulation, it's short on enforcement.
That's exactly the distinction. Israel has comprehensive safety regulations on the books. The problem is inspection density. The number of labor inspectors per construction worker in Israel is abysmally low. Kav Lauaved, which is the main workers' rights advocacy group tracking this, has documented that there's roughly one inspector per several thousand construction sites. The probability of a site being visited in any given year is not high.
You've got a regulatory framework that exists on paper but functions like a scarecrow in a field of crows that have figured out it's not real.
That's a very corn way of putting it, but yes. And the crows, in this metaphor, are subcontractors who know that the odds of an inspector showing up are close to zero.
Let's talk about the labor question, because that's the part of the prompt that jumps out. Dubiously legal labor. What does that actually mean on an Israeli construction site?
It means several overlapping things. First, a significant portion of the construction workforce in Israel is Palestinian workers from the West Bank, many of whom enter through a permit system that is inconsistent, politically volatile, and creates a power imbalance where workers are reluctant to report safety violations because they fear losing their permits or being deported. Second, there's a substantial number of workers who are undocumented altogether. Third, there's a subcontracting chain problem where the general contractor subcontracts to a smaller firm, which subcontracts to an even smaller one, and by the time you reach the person actually pouring concrete on the 7th floor, there's no clear employer of record taking responsibility for that worker's safety.
The legal responsibility dissolves somewhere around subcontractor number 4.
Dissolves is the right word. Kav Lauaved has documented cases where a worker is injured or killed and it takes months to establish who the actual employer was, because the chain of contracts is deliberately opaque. And in the meantime, the worker's family gets nothing.
The labor structure itself is a safety hazard, before you even get to the physical dangers.
And this is not unique to Israel, by the way. You see similar dynamics in the Gulf states, in parts of Southeast Asia. But what makes Israel's case specific is the combination of a formal regulatory system that looks Western on paper and an informal labor market that operates under entirely different rules.
Two systems running in parallel, and the gap between them is where people get killed.
Now, the other major cause of construction fatalities in Israel after falls is being struck by falling objects. Materials dropped from heights, unsecured loads, cranes operating without proper exclusion zones. Then you've got electrocution, usually from contact with overhead power lines during work at height. And then there's being caught in or between collapsing structures, trench cave-ins especially.
Trench collapses are one of those things that sound like a 19th century problem, but are very much still with us.
They're still with us everywhere. Trench collapses kill workers in the United States, in the UK, in Australia. The difference is that in countries with strong enforcement, an unprotected trench deeper than a certain depth is an automatic stop work order. In Israel, the trench gets dug, the worker climbs in, and nobody checks.
That's construction. What about agriculture? You said the fatality profile is completely different.
Agriculture is dominated by tractor accidents. Rollovers, where the tractor tips on uneven terrain and crushes the operator. Entanglements with power takeoff shafts, which are the spinning rods that transfer power from the tractor to attached equipment like balers or mowers. If your clothing gets caught in an unguarded PTO shaft, it can wrap your entire body around it in under a second.
That's a horrifying image.
It's one of the most gruesome mechanisms of death in any industry, and it's almost entirely preventable with a simple guard, a metal or plastic shield that covers the rotating shaft. In countries with strong agricultural safety enforcement, PTO guards are mandatory and their absence triggers immediate fines. In Israel, enforcement on agricultural safety is even thinner than on construction.
Why is agriculture less scrutinized? You'd think food production would get attention.
Partly because agricultural work happens in dispersed, rural settings where inspectors rarely go. Partly because many agricultural workers are foreign laborers, often from Thailand, who are brought in under bilateral agreements and have even less ability to advocate for themselves than construction workers. And partly because there's a cultural perception that farming is somehow a traditional, natural activity rather than an industrial one, which makes safety regulation feel like overreach to some.
The pastoral fallacy. Cows and olive trees don't need OSR.
But modern agriculture is heavily mechanized and involves heavy machinery, chemicals, confined spaces like silos and grain bins, and sometimes extreme heat. It's an industrial workplace with a bucolic paint job.
What about heat? That's the other thing that comes up in agricultural accident reports.
Heat stress is a major factor, and it's getting worse with climate change. Agricultural workers in Israel during summer months are regularly working in temperatures above 35 degrees Celsius, sometimes above 40. Heat exhaustion leads to impaired judgment, slower reaction times, and eventually heat stroke, which can be fatal. And again, foreign workers in particular may be reluctant to stop working or demand water breaks because they fear being seen as lazy or difficult.
The same power imbalance problem from construction shows up in agriculture, just with a different workforce.
Same dynamic, different crop.
Let me ask the obvious question. If the enforcement gap is this well documented, why hasn't it been fixed? What's the political obstacle?
One is that construction in Israel is a politically powerful industry. The Contractors Association has significant lobbying influence. Two, there's a perpetual housing crisis in Israel, and the government is under constant pressure to build faster and cheaper, which creates a disincentive to impose costly safety requirements that might slow down projects. Three, the Labor Inspectorate is chronically underfunded and understaffed, and expanding it costs money that successive governments haven't prioritized.
You've got a triangle of pressure. Build fast, build cheap, don't ask questions.
The fourth factor, which is uncomfortable but real, is that a significant portion of the workforce is politically voiceless. Palestinian workers from the West Bank don't vote in Israeli elections. Foreign workers from Thailand or elsewhere don't vote. The workers who are most at risk have the least political leverage to demand protection.
That's the grim structural reality underneath the statistics.
And it's worth noting that Israeli workers on construction sites also get injured and killed. But the fatality rate among Palestinian and foreign workers is disproportionately higher. Kavlovets data shows that non-Israeli workers account for a majority of construction fatalities despite being a minority of the workforce.
The hazard isn't evenly distributed. The most dangerous jobs go to the most vulnerable workers, and the enforcement system doesn't reach them.
That's the pattern you see globally, not just in Israel. But Israel's specific political and legal arrangements make the dynamic particularly stark.
Let's shift to the comparative question. Which countries have actually figured this out? Who's leading our legislation, inspection, and enforcement?
The gold standard globally is probably the United Kingdom. The Health and Safety Executive, the HSE, was established in 1974 under the Health and Safety at Work Act, and it operates with a level of independence, funding, and legal authority that most countries envy. The UK's construction fatality rate is among the lowest in the world. For context, in 2023, the UK recorded 45 construction fatalities total across the entire country for the whole year.
That's remarkably low.
It's one of the lowest rates in the world, and they achieve it through a combination of things. Mandatory notification of projects to the HSE before work begins. A requirement for a principal designer and principal contractor to be formally appointed with specific safety responsibilities. Regular, unannounced inspections with real enforcement teeth. The HSE can issue prohibition notices that shut down a site immediately, and they do. And most importantly, the construction design and management regulations from 2015, known as CDM 2015, which embed safety planning from the design phase onward, rather than treating it as something the contractor figures out later.
Safety isn't bolted on at the end. It's baked into the design.
That's the core philosophy. And it works. The CDM regulations require that designers, architects, and engineers explicitly consider how their design choices affect the safety of the people who will build and later maintain the structure. If you design a roof with no anchor points for fall protection, you've created a hazard before the first brick is laid, and the HSE can hold the designer accountable.
That's a fundamentally different way of thinking about responsibility. Most countries put all the liability on the contractor who's actually doing the work.
That's precisely why most countries have worse outcomes. The UK model recognizes that safety is a supply chain problem. Everyone upstream shares responsibility.
Who else is worth looking at?
Singapore is fascinating because they went from a terrible safety record to one of the best in the world in about 15 years. In the early 2000s, Singapore's construction fatality rate was comparable to Israel's current numbers. They had a series of high-profile accidents, including a collapse of an expressway viaduct that killed several workers, and the government decided to overhaul everything.
What did they actually change?
They created a dedicated occupational safety and health division with significant staffing. They introduced mandatory safety management systems for all construction projects above a certain value. They required project managers and supervisors to undergo formal safety training and certification. They dramatically increased fines for violations, including personal liability for company directors. And they introduced a demerit point system for contractors. Accumulate too many violations, and you're barred from bidding on public projects.
The demerit point system is interesting because it turns safety into a business continuity issue. Lose your points, lose your revenue.
It aligns the contractor's financial interest with safety outcomes, which is the only way to make compliance stick. Singapore's construction fatality rate dropped from roughly 9 per 100,000 workers to under 2 in about a decade.
That's a dramatic turnaround.
It shows that it can be done. The question isn't whether it's possible, it's whether there's political will.
What about the Nordic countries? I always hear them cited as safety leaders.
Finland and Sweden both have excellent records, but their models are slightly different from the UK's. They rely more heavily on tripartite cooperation. Government, employer associations, and trade unions working together to set standards and monitor compliance. The union density in construction in Finland is extremely high, around 70% or more, and union safety representatives have legal authority to stop work if they identify an imminent danger.
That's a level of worker empowerment that's almost unimaginable in the Israeli context.
Right, because it requires a strong, well-organized labor movement with legal backing. In Israel, union density in construction is very low, and the workers who are most at risk aren't unionized at all.
The Nordic model isn't easily transplantable. The preconditions aren't there.
The UK and Singapore models are probably more relevant as comparators because they rely more on regulatory enforcement and less on labor movement strength. Though even the UK's model assumes an inspectorate with adequate staffing, which brings us back to the funding question.
Let me ask about something that's been in the Israeli news cycle. There have been several high-profile construction accidents recently that prompted public outcry. Does that pattern, accident, outrage, promises, fade, actually lead to change anywhere? Or is it just the standard cycle?
It's the standard cycle in most countries, but there are examples where a particularly shocking accident has catalyzed real reform. The Singapore viaduct collapse I mentioned was one. In Australia, a crane collapse in Melbourne in 2013 led to significant reforms in crane safety regulation. In the UK, the Piper Alpha oil platform disaster in 1988 completely transformed offshore safety regulation. So catalytic accidents can work, but they require sustained political attention after the headlines fade.
Sustained attention is the hard part.
It's always the hard part. The pattern in Israel has been that a worker dies, there's a Knesset committee hearing, promises are made, and then 6 months later nothing has changed and another worker dies.
The grim predictability of it is part of the tragedy.
There's a concept in safety science called the normalization of deviance. It's when unsafe practices become so routine that they stop being seen as deviant at all. You walk past an unguarded edge every day, and eventually your brain stops registering it as a hazard. I think that's where Israel's construction industry is. The unsafe conditions have become background noise.
The workers who experience them most acutely are the ones society is most willing to ignore.
And that's not a safety problem anymore. That's a moral problem.
Let's talk about what good inspection actually looks like. Practically, you mentioned unannounced visits.
Effective inspection has several components. Sites need to be visited often enough that the probability of an inspection during any given project phase is high. If inspections are scheduled or telegraphed, contractors clean up for the visit and revert afterward. Inspectors need the power to issue immediate stop work orders without going through layers of bureaucratic approval. Fines need to be large enough to hurt. In the UK, the HSE can issue fines in the millions of pounds for serious violations. In Singapore, company directors can face imprisonment.
What's the fine structure in Israel?
Historically, fines have been low enough that contractors treat them as a cost of doing business. There have been some increases in recent years, but enforcement remains inconsistent. And criminal prosecution of employers after a fatality is rare.
The deterrent effect is minimal.
If the expected cost of non-compliance, discounted by the probability of getting caught, is lower than the cost of compliance, rational actors will choose non-compliance. That's not ideology, that's just math.
The cost of compliance includes things like proper scaffolding, fall protection systems, safety training, site supervision.
All of which costs money and time. A contractor who's competing on price in a tight market has every incentive to cut those corners if the enforcement risk is low.
This is where the housing crisis point you mentioned earlier becomes relevant. If the government is pushing for speed and volume, it's implicitly pushing against safety.
There's an inherent tension between speed and safety in construction. You can build fast, you can build safe, or you can build cheap. Pick two. Governments that demand all three are effectively demanding that someone else absorb the cost, and that someone is usually the worker.
Let's circle back to agriculture, because we spent less time there. What would good agricultural safety enforcement look like?
Regular inspection of farms, especially during high-risk periods like harvest. Mandatory rollover protection structures on all tractors. This is a steel frame or cab that prevents the tractor from crushing the operator if it tips. PTO shaft guarding, as I mentioned. Heat stress protocols that mandate water, shade, and rest breaks above certain temperature thresholds. And proper housing and working conditions for foreign agricultural workers, because fatigue from poor living conditions is itself a safety hazard.
Are any of these required by Israeli law?
Some are on the books. Rollover protection has been required on new tractors for years. But enforcement on existing equipment is spotty, and agricultural labor inspection is even more under-resourced than construction inspection.
What about the countries that do agriculture well?
Australia and New Zealand have strong agricultural safety records, driven partly by geography. Farms are large and remote, so getting injured means you might not be found for hours, which creates a strong incentive for prevention. The UK's agricultural safety record is decent, but not as strong as its construction record. The United States has significant agricultural safety problems, particularly among migrant workers, that parallel some of Israel's issues.
Agriculture is a tougher nut to crack globally, not just in Israel.
agriculture consistently ranks as one of the most dangerous industries worldwide, across developed and developing countries alike. The difference is that in countries with strong enforcement, the fatality rate is maybe 3 to 5 per 100,000 workers. In countries with weak enforcement, it can be 10 to 20. Israel is probably in the middle of that range, but the data is less reliable because agricultural accidents are underreported.
Underreporting is itself a symptom of the problem.
It's a huge issue. If a Thai agricultural worker dies on a remote farm in the Negev and the employer doesn't report it, does it show up in the statistics? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Kav Lavid and other groups have documented cases where fatalities were initially classified as natural causes or accidents unrelated to work.
That's convenient for the employer.
It's convenient for everyone except the dead worker and their family.
Let me ask you a more philosophical question. Is there something about the nature of construction and agriculture that makes them inherently dangerous in a way that, say, office work isn't? Or is the danger entirely a product of how we choose to regulate them?
There's a baseline hazard that's real. Heavy machinery is dangerous. Working at height or around moving equipment will never be as safe as sitting at a desk. But the variation between countries shows that the baseline hazard is not the main driver of outcomes. The UK and Israel both have gravity. The UK and Israel both have construction workers who need to work at height. The UK's fatality rate is a fraction of Israel's. The difference is entirely in the system surrounding the work.
It's not that construction is inherently deadly. It's that construction without proper safeguards is inherently deadly.
And the safeguards are well understood. They're not mysterious. Fall protection, proper scaffolding, safety training, competent supervision, regular inspection, real consequences for violations. None of this is new technology. It's been standard practice in the UK for decades.
Which makes the persistence of the problem in Israel more frustrating, not less. It's not that we don't know what to do, it's that we're not doing it.
That's what makes the public perception accurate. When Israelis look at construction sites and see workers on scaffolding without harnesses, or walking across rebar without fall protection, they're not imagining things. Those conditions would trigger an immediate shutdown in London or Singapore.
What's the role of media coverage in all this? Does sustained coverage actually move the needle?
The Singapore case was partly driven by media attention after the viaduct collapse. In Israel, there have been periods of intense media coverage after high-profile accidents, and those periods have sometimes led to temporary increases in enforcement activity. But the pattern is that coverage fades, enforcement fades, and the baseline doesn't shift.
The ratchet never clicks forward. It just goes back to where it was.
That's the cycle. And breaking it requires institutional change, not just reactive enforcement blitzes. You need more inspectors, higher fines, clearer legal responsibility up the contracting chain, and a political commitment to fund those things year after year.
Which brings us to the question of what's politically achievable. You mentioned the contractors' lobby and the housing crisis pressure. Are there any political forces pushing in the other direction?
Kav Lavid and other advocacy groups have been pushing for reforms for years. There have been Nesset bills proposed to increase inspector hiring, to impose personal liability on company directors, to require safety management systems on large projects. Some have passed in weakened form, some haven't passed at all. The advocacy exists. The political will to overcome the countervailing pressures hasn't materialized.
Is there a public opinion dimension? Do Israelis care about this issue?
Surveys suggest they do, especially after high-profile accidents. But it's not a top-tier electoral issue the way housing prices or security are. It's one of those things that people care about in the abstract but don't vote on.
Which is the political equivalent of thoughts and prayers.
That's a little harsh, but not entirely wrong.
I'm a sloth. I have time for harshness.
The point is that safety regulation is a classic public good. Everyone benefits from it. But the costs are concentrated on a specific industry that's highly motivated to resist, while the beneficiaries are diffuse and less organized.
The classic asymmetry of regulatory politics.
And it plays out the same way in country after country. The difference is that some countries overcame it decades ago and built durable institutions, while others are still stuck in the cycle.
What would it take for Israel to build a durable institution like the UK's HSE?
A dedicated, independent agency with its own budget and staffing that isn't subject to annual political horse trading. statutory authority to issue stop work orders and levy substantial fines without ministerial approval, a requirement for mandatory safety planning from the design phase, like the UK's CDM regulations, personal liability for company directors when safety violations lead to death, and a commitment to hiring and training enough inspectors to actually visit sites regularly.
That sounds expensive.
The UK's HSE budget is hundreds of millions of pounds annually, but the counterargument is that the cost of not doing it is also expensive, in lost lives, in disability payments, in lost productivity, in the human cost to families. Safety regulation is an investment that pays for itself many times over. The UK's construction industry is not less productive than Israel's because of safety regulation. If anything, safer sites are more efficient because you're not constantly dealing with accidents, investigations, and workforce disruption.
The business case for safety is actually pretty strong, if you take a long enough view.
It's overwhelming. The problem is that individual contractors are optimizing for the next quarter, not the next decade. Regulation exists to solve exactly that kind of market failure.
Let's talk about one more dimension that the prompt raised. The public perception question. Is the Israeli public actually aware of how bad the numbers are compared to other countries?
I think there's a general awareness that construction sites are dangerous. But I'm not sure most Israelis know that their country's fatality rate is 2 to 3 times the OECD average. The comparative dimension isn't well covered in Hebrew language media. When a worker falls from a scaffold, it's reported as a tragic accident, not as a systemic failure that puts Israel in the same league as countries with far weaker regulatory systems.
The framing matters. If every death is an isolated tragedy, there's no pattern to fix. If they're symptoms of a systemic problem, the solution has to be systemic.
That's the shift that hasn't happened in public discourse. The media covers the accidents. It doesn't cover the system that produces them.
What's the one thing you'd change tomorrow if you had a magic wand?
Everything else, the regulations, the fines, the liability rules, is meaningless if nobody's checking. You can have the best laws in the world, but if the probability of an inspector showing up is near zero, those laws are just words on paper. I'd triple the Construction Safety Inspectorate and fund it with a levy on construction projects above a certain value. Make the industry pay for its own oversight.
That's a clever funding mechanism. It aligns incentives too. Safer contractors subsidize less, because they have fewer incidents.
You could structure it that way. A safety levy that's reduced for contractors with good records. Singapore does something similar with their demerit system. Good contractors pay lower insurance premiums and get preference on public tenders.
There are models. The question is whether anyone in a position to implement them is paying attention.
That's always the question. And the answer, for now, seems to be that the political system responds to tragedy with rhetoric and to lobbying with inaction.
That's a bleak note to end on, but I think it's an honest one. Before we wrap up, let me try to summarize what we've covered. Construction fatalities in Israel are dominated by falls from height, running at 2 to 3 times the OECD average. The enforcement gap is real. Regulations exist, but inspectors don't. The labor structure, with its subcontracting chains and vulnerable workers, compounds the hazard. Agriculture has a different fatality profile, tractor rollovers and machinery entanglements, with even weaker enforcement. The UK, Singapore, and the Nordics have shown that better outcomes are possible through independent inspectorates, design phase safety planning, and real consequences for violations. And the barrier to change in Israel isn't a lack of knowledge, it's a lack of political will.
That's a fair summary. I'd add that the public perception of substandard safety is accurate, and that the comparative data backs it up. Israel is not where it should be for a country at its level of economic development.
One open question I'll leave listeners with. If the cost of safety regulation is an investment that pays for itself, and the cost of not regulating is borne disproportionately by the most vulnerable workers, what exactly are we waiting for?
That's the question, isn't it?
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
By the 1860s, the population of Kiribati had developed a distinctive method of fermenting coconut sap into an alcoholic drink called kareve, a process that relied entirely on wild yeast colonizing the sap within hours of tapping the palm flower. A fermentation so rapid that by midday the drink was already mildly effervescent and at risk of turning to vinegar before sundown.
The coconut sap clock is ticking.
That's somehow both a beverage and a deadline.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.